Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamal Murray. And today we have a living legend, a person I consider a mentor, always in the background. You never hear him, but you always see him. He sneak up on you and give you one little piece of sound advice. A coach and mentor to many people that we consider great today. He's been the force behind Black tennis for a long time. We got the pleasure of being here today with Willis Thomas. Willis, welcome.
Thank you, Kamal.
So, man, you hiding out in Florida now. You know, I hear when people retire and they put them miles in and they earn their years, they earn their stripes up in that D.C. area, they move to Florida.
Well, that seems to be the place to go. It's been pretty cold this winter, so I'm glad I'm in Florida. It's just a good place to retire to. As a tennis coach, I always wanted to be able to retire. I didn't want to be feeding balls until my 80s. I didn't want to do it, so I'm thankful.
Now, you know what's funny is that one of the things, when I decided to leave my corporate job and go deep into, you know, coaching tennis full time, one of the things that made me a little insecure and a little nervous was the thought of retirement, because very few organizations, like when you out there, you're working for a nonprofit or you're working in the park and you kind of running your own show, you don't really have a 401k, right? You know what I mean? So coaching in the tennis circuit, where a lot of people are independent, right? Working in the parks, maybe traveling with a professional player, it doesn't come with a 401k. When you were traveling with some of the players, you thought, did you ever consider that? Did you ever see it as being a real risk?
Oh, no doubt. It was a real risk. But it was something that, you know, that I wanted to do, that I think needed to be done. And, you know, you have to take chances. Plus, the girls weren't making that much money in those days. So even if you got paid, you didn't get paid that much, just enough to kind of survive. But I would do it all over again.
Yeah. Now, you talk about the girls. You are famous for coaching, you know, Rodney Harmon, Katrina Adams, Lori McNeil, and Zena Garrison. Tell me a little bit about Rodney, because right now Rodney is considered one of the best African-American, if not one of the best coaches in America now, currently at Georgia Tech, having a ton of success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, good coaches were always raised by good coaches. So that's a testament to you that he's considered one of the good coaches. But Rodney seems very poised and controlled now. Tell us about Rodney as a tennis player. Was he the same, or did he have that wild streak to him?
No, he wasn't. He didn't have a wild streak. Actually, he loved tennis. You know, Rodney was the type of kid who, he lived in Richmond and I lived in Washington. So we had to coach over the telephone. I would tell him something and he says, okay, I'm going to go work on it. And I said, but Rodney, it's raining down there. He said, that's okay. I can hit on the wall. So he was one of those types of players who didn't let anything stop him. If he wanted to you know, improve a stroke or, change a serve, he let nothing stop him. He would do it until he got it. He was one of those types of players. Though they're easy to coach, you just mentally have to make sure that they stay together. A lot of people can play, but they can't keep it together, you know. So That's generally what I did to all of the players that I coach. I was more of a mental coach. I learned that from Dr. Walter Johnson, who was the only coach I ever had, who coaches Arthur and myself. He was a mental coach. He wanted you to toe the line mentally. And he was a good, he lived it. I mean, you looked at him and you just wanted to be, God, how can you be as strong as this guy, Dr. Johnson? But he put those mental things in your head and always coached you mentally. So I always coach sort of mentally. When I coach Zena and Lori, they already knew how to play, but you wanted to try to make them better. But you could only do that if you improve them mentally.
So tell me about Lori, because Lori was famous. I mean, she had, you know, deep runs at Wimbledon, one of the, I mean, quintessential serving volley, could chip and charge. You talk about women like, yeah, when I think of Martina Navratilova, I think of also Lori McNeil in terms of being able to chip, move forward, had touch, was always poised. Tell us about Lori McNeil. And she's still kind of that way, you know, kind of soft-spoken, but when you get her talking, she won't stop talking.
Yeah, Lori was a great athlete, just a great athlete. You know, she was fast. She could move and you didn't see her moving. You know, one of those types of athletes. Very smooth with her strokes. And, you know, she came from a lineage of professional athletes because her father was a professional football player. So I think that she inherited a lot of his guts and she played her style. Even when you tried to sometimes change her style, you couldn't do it. She was wedded to that, putting that pressure on you and coming to the net. And even when it wasn't fashionable to come to the net, she's still coming to the net. And just a great athlete. Figured if I can get up to that net, I can flag any of those balls that are trying to go by me or over me. She was just an outstanding athlete, one of the best athletes I ever coached.
And you know, it's funny, we talk about her, you know, she was a USTA national coach, and a lot of the girls today, when I'm just out on tour and I'm listening to them and they talk about the camps they used to go to, Lori's name always comes up as somebody that left a mark on them. And I think, you know, that's a testament to you, because I say you can't be a good coach if you didn't have good coaches. And
yeah, Lori, and
one of the best.
Yeah. And Lori also learned from one of the best too, and John Wilkerson. Mm-hmm. So, who was also a top coach. I learned a lot from John myself, and we worked together for a long time. And so, you know, she had a bevy of coaches, not just me, but she had John. And when you go back and you start coaching other people, you do coach in the same way you were kind of coached yourself.
And then Zena. So I heard a lot of stories and really got a lot of insight about you from Zena Garrison. Back when I was coaching alongside her, she would always talk about Willie T and, you know, Willis used to get on my nerves. And, you know, Willis, he just would not leave me alone. And he would just press me and press me. And that kind of thing. Tell us about, you know, when you think about the single success, obviously Zena of that bunch probably had the most success. Tell us about Zena Garrison.
Well, Zena was tough. And I've always said the good players, they are tough. Zena was mean. I mean, she would, but, you know, to try to show her how to use that in her tennis, that's what kind of I did with Zena. Zena, don't change your personality. You are what you are, but mean on the court. Don't be mean to me. You know what I mean? And she was able to do that. I mean, she won some matches that were just, I mean, fabulous matches. And she was just a tough young lady, you know, and I just had to, I used to always say, well, what did you do with Zena? I said, well, I just had to get her ready to be on the court. You know, not by her strokes, but calm her down. You know what I mean? And get her ready to go out there and try to work on somebody and try to really hurt him, because he was one of those mean type of players, you know what I mean, who would just bring it to you, you know what I mean? And the first time I met Zena, she was playing doubles, and she would just take that forehand and just knock it at those little girls. She was about 12, and I said, God, she's just hitting right at the girls, you know what I mean? She was just one tough cookie, and showing her how to put that into her tennis game and incorporate all of that into her training. She could train harder than anybody I've ever seen. And so those are some of the things we had to do. But like I said, mainly mental, because they could already play when I started coaching them. They could already play. Rodney was the only one I kind of coached from a kid all the way up. So I can say I was responsible for some of those ugly strokes Rodney had. But, but Zena. Over the phone strokes that Rodney had. And but Zena was just tough. He was tough. So showing her how to just put that and, you know, use that when she played versus use it off the court, you know what I mean? Be nice off the court, but keep that mean streak for on the court.
So let me ask you, because, you know, I've been with some players and it become match day, and you're right, mm-hmm. you could tell either the nerves or maybe it's not, they're not feeling as confident, that they could get mean. Did you, mm-hmm. so on match day, did Zena's meanness show up when she started? You like got to stay out the way because she on a rampage for anybody that's in her way.
Yeah, you had to kind of, you know, in working with girls, you just have to be clever. You know, boys, you can hit them right between the eyes with something that you want to say, but you can't do that with girls. You know, you have to be clever in how you get them to understand what you're trying to get them to do. You know, and so with Zena, depending on the day, depending on what type of cleverness you use, you know what I mean? But of course, once she got to the court, she was in good shape.
I just had to get her there. Now, I remember one summer, it was City Open. And, you know, with these jobs and these long relationships, they can go up and down and, you know, they always get tough and, you know, you just stay together. But you said, come on, you ain't a real coach till you get fired. And you said, Zena fired me 3 or 4 times. Tell us about that experience and why she would bring you back.
Well, it was the experience of, you know, I believe in something. I believe if you do it this way or if you act this way that you get rewards from it, and they think different. So you get to that little point where you're not agreeing, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. on how this should be done. So you have to separate just to, you know what I mean, to, well, you have to really, because once, you know, they're so mad at you that they can't play. You know, they're going to put it all on you. So you almost have to. But what happened with Zena and I, we never lost our respect for each other. You know, it's like Zena knew I had to go because she knew I wasn't going to put up with some things that were going on, you know, even to keep my job. You see what I mean? And that's why I say if you never haven't been fired, you really haven't been a coach. All you've done is go out there and tell the girls what they want to hear, or the boys or whoever you're coaching, what they want to hear versus what they really need to hear, which sometimes can, you know, cause a little problems in your relationship.
You always say, you got to poke the bear. If something need to be said, you better say it. Because when they get out on that court, yeah. it's going to be too late. And yeah. you're going to wish yeah. you had said it.
Yeah, as a coach, you just have to do it, even though, you know, it could be repercussions. But you have to. You wouldn't be a good coach if you didn't tell them what you think. You know, and sometimes what you think and what they think will clash, no doubt about it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I heard that you were old school. So every day at Wimbledon, you know, you famous for getting up and reading the tabloids and having your coffee. Is that true? Did you like some of the British tabloids?
Oh yeah, I used to like to read the tabloids. I'm a sort of a reader anyway. I read the paper every morning. I still read the paper. I can't read the internet. But I can read the paper. I'm a page turner. So, you know, that's just something that kind of let me know what's going on. I always wanted to know what's going on where we were. Even some of the French papers, I mean, I could gather something from just looking at it, even though I didn't really know how to speak French. But I still read the paper, you know, and you can get something. At least you can look at the pictures, you know what I mean? But it kind of got me ready for the day, you know, knowing what's happening in the world and, you know, gets me ready for the day.
Now, you were doubles partners with Arthur Ashe. And, you know, Arthur was just so instrumental in just tennis in general. And, you know, most people don't know that he started the NJTL, the National Junior Tennis League. I mean, he had instructional videos. He had all of that. For those of us who, you know, maybe didn't have the privilege to really get that close to him and get to know him, tell us about him. Because when I was growing up, my friends used to make fun of me. They used to call me Arthur Trash because I was real skinny with a big head. They were like, yeah, you're like Arthur Ashe. We're going to call you Arthur Trash. So tell us a little bit about your time with Arthur.
Well, my time with Arthur, you know, that occurred when we were really young, from like 12 to 15. You know, we played doubles together. We won a lot in the American Tennis Association, and we played Kalamazoo and some of those matches. We would get to the quarterfinals sometimes, but we never won it. But Arthur was he was just one heck of a player. I've seen him in those days, you know, playing against, you know, the white players, that was different. We usually didn't do that. So he was a kind, he could be mentally tough, even to those who were trying to oppress you. I couldn't see that. I was a little scared of him. Yeah, the oppressors, and Arthur would be just as tough to them. To give you an example, we were in New York one day playing the Eastern Junior Boys at Forest Hills, and Arthur lost to this kid pretty easily. I mean, like 3-3. And, you know, Arthur was, like you say, he was a small, skinny kid, so the guys on the team would always tease him. The next week, 2 weeks later, we were playing in Kalamazoo. He drew the player in the first round, the same guy who just beat him. So, of course, we were teasing him that he's going to lose because all of us have already lost. And Arthur beat the boy 6-love, 6-love. I mean, just cold-blooded, killed it. And when I saw that, I knew then that this guy had something that none of us had, and that he's going to go a long way. I didn't really know until I saw that match how he destroyed that boy. And like you say, playing against white people all the time, it was kind of hard. You know, they look good. The strokes always look good. We had our homemade, homegrown strokes, and you know what I mean? And but it never feared Arthur. He just went out there and just tried to kill him if he could. So
After that match, I knew he was going to be just a great player. He always knew what he wanted to do. When he was 13 or 14, he said he was going to UCLA. And we used to tease him and say, you're not going to UCLA. And he used to say, well, Jackie Robinson went to UCLA. I can go to UCLA. So he always thought of himself in those terms of a Jackie Robinson, you know what I mean? And he was a Jackie Robinson of tennis. And it's just, as you look back and you could see all the signs that he was going to be one of our great players. You know?
So when was the, you know, when you're coming up with juniors and you're playing with a pack, right? You know, there's everybody kind of seem all the same, you're traveling together. And then there's always like a summer, like a 3-month period where one guy sort of just separates. Yeah. When was that? And what do you think caused that separation? Because I, you know, all of you guys were kind of the same, traveling together. And then all of a sudden, Arthur just seemed to just take off. What
well,
the difference?
Yeah, I think, it is, like you say, it was mentally. Because some of us, if you look at us, you say, God, you're great athletes. I mean, y'all look much better than Arthur. You know what I mean? As far as athletically. But mentally, we could not catch him. You know, for a kid at that age to be able to control himself mentally. When you played a match against Arthur, you played against Arthur, he didn't say nothing. He never said a word. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He never uttered anything. You never knew whether you were getting to him or not. Mm-hmm. He would never let you know. Then he'd end up doing all the getting. You know what I mean? It's like you destroyed yourself trying to find out how come he's not upset over that good shot you just hit on him. You know what I mean? He was that type of person, and he could really just mentally get it together and go into that zone and not come out until he won.
You know?
And that was hard for younger kids.
You see that today, right? You see, when I look at a lot of the slams, right, or even a lot of the finals, and you see, obviously, both players playing well enough to get there. Both players are in shape, otherwise they wouldn't be there. And then you just see one person just sort of hold it together. What do you see this generation being the same as the Zena Garrison era, Martina and Zena and Chrissy? Because to me, it seems like, especially on the women's side, we don't have a consistent champion other than Serena, right? They sort of trade in tournaments every week, gets a new champion, mm-hmm. A new winner. You know, what do you think about what that says about the game mentally?
Well, I know in the women's game, for a woman to keep it together as long as, say, like a Serena did, you have to put in a lot of things in your life on hold. You know, you have to put it on hold. And some of them don't have the ability to do that, to put it on hold, mainly the relationships and stuff like that. You got to put it on hold where, you know, men can have a girlfriend in every port, as they say. You know, but the women always had to put that part of their life on hold. And I think some of them just couldn't hold long enough, you know, to be that person who's going to be perennially winning all the time. And I think that's what you have now. They get so much money for these girls, they can live a little while they're making money, you know, where the other, and back during Zena's career, you had to save your money because you weren't making that much money, you know. So you couldn't go out here and do all the things that you might have wanted to do. So it kind of kept you a little close to the game. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't get far away from the game. But the girls today, they're making so much money. It's easy to, you know, just get away from the game.
Now, you spent a lot of your immediate years now working with the Washington Tennis and Education Foundation, working with the youth, working with, kids in the inner city that are trying to give this game a shot, right? Trying to get exposed to this game and like love it. You know, I also have the privilege of, you know, doing the same thing, right? Just working with kids and staying close to the game at the younger age. Tell us about your time at the WTEF and how rewarding that was.
Well, you know, working with the kids are a lot of fun. Most of the time, more fun than it was out there on that pro circuit. But I always, I found out early in my tennis coaching career that tennis could help some of these kids in these challenged neighborhoods, could help them in a lot of ways. Number one, it was an individual sport, and they don't play many individual sports in the city, in the inner city. You know, we might have track, but that's about it. So it was a individual sport, and we also worked with them on the using the acronym I always use, never no dumb tennis players. So if you like tennis, you a smart person already. So it was just to use the how the tennis helped them in their classwork, because taking a test is like playing a match. It's the same thing, you know, so you could use some of the same terminology that you used on the tennis court to help them also with their schoolwork. And my job wasn't to make them champions. I wasn't looking for a champion. I was just trying to get them through high school without going to jail. You know what I mean? So being an individual sport, if they took to it, you know, you really, they could, the individual sports can really grab you where you fall in love with them. Some of the kids fell in love with them. Then if you're doing it in the community, the younger kids can't wait until they get a chance to be on the team so they can go on the trips and do some of the things that you're doing. So, I mean, those are the things that I like doing most, was working with those kids and seeing how tennis helped them escape some of those perils of the neighborhood. And that's just something I did most of my life. I started tennis to make money, but when I found out that how tennis helped those kids, I took a vow of poverty. And I had more fun helping those kids than, you know, helping the kids who could pay you a lot of money, you know.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, you definitely had the opportunity to work with some great players, even though they were kids at the time. I remember a long time ago, you were telling me about Malkia, Claire V, and now you see them, you know, out there playing now. Malkia's in college, Claire V, you know, now is probably one of the most promising American juniors. So you see the impact of having tennis in the inner city,
and no doubt about it,
how, you know, you don't know at when they 6, 7, 8, 9 that you are gonna be touching greatness, but you know, you gotta just keep trying. You saw Clavie at a young age, didn't you?
Yeah, I saw her at a very young age before she started playing tennis, and of course she always wanted to do what her older sister was doing. So later on, she became to really like tennis. She didn't like it too much at first, clearly, but she began to love it. And all she wanted to do was play tennis. Of course, she wanted to beat her sister, but her sister didn't have anybody to, you know, to kind of want to beat. So, you know, how the younger ones usually turn out sometimes to be a little better than the older ones because they're a little hungrier. You know, and so I think that seeing kids like Clara V and The other girl was in our program also for a while. I can't call her name, but we've had quite a few people who have started and then gone on to better programs, as the parents would say. But it started right there in the neighborhood.
So you got like a lot of talent now in America. So you got Coco Golf, you got Claire V, you got Sloan, Madison. I mean, just, you know, we are rich with Robin Montgomery. We are rich with like African-American talent right now. What advice would you give them? Right, because again, from a diversity standpoint, we made a little bit of progress, but still got a long way to go. Probably not enough progress. There's still going to be, you know, 1 out of 10 at the tournament that's Black. What advice do you have for them to try to help them have long careers without straying too far from home, from who they are as person, as people?
And that's the hard part. That's the hard part, because they get immersed in something that's not like anything else in the world when they get on that tour. I think that's the hardest part. My answer to them was to, you know, have a good group around you that supports you and keep you grounded in who you are. I see a lot of cases, some of the African-American girls, they get up and they seem to lose sense on who they are, you know. And if they continue to work on, continue being yourself, I think they have a better chance.
Well, man, Willie T, Willis Thomas, the legend. I appreciate you coming on to the show. I know you retired. I know you're hard to find, and you know we're taking into your golf time right now. But I appreciate you coming on the podcast. I couldn't let Black History Month go by without spending some time with you and taking us back through time with some of the people that you just had the privilege of being around, from Arthur to Zena to Kat to Lori. Let's talk about Kat before I let you go, though, because.
Yeah, you got to talk about
it. She grew up in Chicago. And
yeah,
she was always, I think, fit to be president, right? She enjoyed networking. She enjoyed talking to people where, you know, people like Zena and Lori was like, all right, I'm going back to the hotel now. Tell us about Katrina. Are you surprised at the success?
Well, we're not surprised at all, because we used to always say that we know Katrina's going to get one of these big jobs in the pro arena, or, you know, the USTA. We just knew it because she was a natural. She was just a natural for the job. You know, her parents had taught her real well how to speak and talk with people. And she enjoyed it, really. You know, you could see her enjoy showing what, as a Black woman, yeah, I've got talents too. You know what I mean? And it was real fun to see her grow into some of those positions she had. And it was just something that we always said she was going to do. So, but as a player, she was a good player too. I mean, she's also, you know, most of these girls, we're talking about Zena, Lori, Katrina, they're playground players. They learn to play on the playground, you know, not from clubs or taking lessons. They learned how to play on the playground. So they come out with the playground games that have to be refined a little bit. But Katrina had a game that, I think if she was a little healthier, Katrina wasn't the healthiest person in the world. And she would always kind of get injured if she, you know, put that 200% into what she's doing. So I said, if it wasn't for that, she could have been, a great player. You know, I saw her at Wimbledon 1 year, have Chris Evert down in the fourth round of Wimbledon, have her down in the third set, but she lost it. You know what I mean? And just playing tough tennis. She was a very tough kid. And, you know, you just love Katrina. Everybody loves Katrina. Mm-hmm. You know, she's one of those type of people and very loyal, one of the most loyal people I've ever met. You know, you don't get much loyalty out there on that tennis circuit.
But it's an individual sport, so they're trying to kill you, right? It's like, I need you to lose so I can win. That's kind of, it is one of the few sports where, you know, if you lose and points drop off, even if I didn't win, my ranking improves.
So it
is one of those sports that does breed a mentality to want to see the other person lose so that you can win, right? The points disappear. They don't get to the quarters again like they got last year and the points drop off. So there's ranking incentive for other people to lose that you're not even playing against, right? You keeping track on their tag.
Right.
And so I do think that part of the sport creates a level of competitiveness sometimes that, you know, might be a little bit unhealthy. But, these people we talked about on the call always, I think, you know, what makes them greats and keeps their name sort of relevant today is that they always want to see everybody else win and we always want to help somebody else improve. So you included, man, I really appreciate you. I appreciate everything you've given me over the years. And I didn't want to let Black History Month go by without pulling you off that golf course and getting your story out there.
Well, thank you, Kamal. And I'm very proud of the things you're doing. You're really taking it to another level.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you. This has been a Tennis.com podcast, and we have had the honor of talking with Willis Thomas. We'll see you next week.